Welcome to the AC Podcast. This is Terry Crosby.
Andy Steiger.
Steve Kim.
Welcome, guys, to another day of podcasting.
It's good to be with you, Terry.
And you, Steve.
Yep.
It's been a while since we've had you on the show, Steve. We've been doing some interviews and we've missed you.
The three amigos are back.
I like that.
So. Yeah, it's good to have you back, Steve.
Yeah.
So I do have a story.
What do you got for us, Terry?
Very short. Nothing crazy today.
Yeah, that's what you told me last time, and I ended up talking about whether hot dog was a sandwich.
That was a good one. That was a good one, yeah. I hope that other people discuss that around the water coolers. This one says, new shuttle service offers free rides, but only if you keep singing. So there's the launch of the new BMW i3, and they're giving shuttles to people. So you can have a free ride in this new BMW i3 electric vehicle.
Okay.
And you have to sing the whole time that you're in the vehicle. And it's free afterwards.
The ride is free.
The ride is free.
If you're willing to sing the whole time.
Yeah.
Is this kind of like a ride-sharing thing / singing?
Well, the videos show a bunch of people in the car itself, right?
Okay.
And they sing the whole time. And your ride is free afterwards.
And they record this in public.
And they've recorded it. Yeah. Yeah.
Hmm.
So
I think they'd make it maybe a block and be like, get out of the car, Steiger. That's horrible.
The promotion for this is that this electric vehicle is so silent that you will hear everything in the car easily as you're singing, you know. So it just brings it that much clearer and louder and nicer to everybody else in the car.
Right. Unless it's me singing.
Exactly.
Yeah, I kind of have to question the wisdom of that.
Yeah.
So this whole car karaoke thing is huge, right? I mean, James Corden does singing with a number of big stars, you know. I think the top car karaoke is with Adele. 184 million views.
Wow.
Going on with that one.
Well, I heard that he had Paul McCartney on recently.
Paul McCartney. That was a good one. I quite enjoy James Corden's car karaoke. That was a good one.
Oh, is that the one where they take Paul McCartney and Paul basically shows the other guy around, like in Liverpool, where he's from?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And then he did some, you know, just went into a pub and started singing for people who didn't know that he was going to be there. So it was great. But my question to you is, what would be the car karaoke song you would sing if you got into a car right now? Into the BMW i3. Silent so they could hear everything you say.
You know, I'd probably sing This Little Light of Mine.
All right. That's a short one.
Yeah.
You'd have to sing it over and over and over again.
Steve, what about you, buddy?
I would probably want to sing I Will Survive.
Nice.
Wow.
Yeah.
I would like to hear that, actually, Steve.
Yeah. No, you don't.
My top song?
Yeah.
Staying Alive by the Bee Gees.
Come on.
I love that song, yeah. Man. That has such a great groove, and it just gets me going. Sing-it-a-wise.
Yeah.
You should edit that one out.
Yeah, Steve. That put images in my mind that I can't get out.
Yeah, no, Staying Alive, Bee Gees, that's a great song.
That just reminds me of John Travolta dancing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Skin-tight suit, white. Oh, yeah.
Bell-bottoms.
Bell-bottoms.
Just flapping in the wind.
Yeah.
Nice.
Anyway, let's move on to our topic today.
I've been looking forward to this one, Terry.
All right.
We are going to be talking on the subject of evolution. The reason I've been looking forward to talking on this is periodically, when we do interviews and have people on, and just periodically when we're talking, we'll say something about evolution. And recently this happened where we had a guest on. We were talking about the book Generation Z, and we had on the show James White, the author. And he was asking, you know, is this a safe place, if you will, to talk about evolution? He just wanted to air some of his frustration, which we were glad to do. But then I had heard from some listeners just asking, you know, Andy, he was airing his frustration on evolution, to which I was happy to agree with, and just a lot of the tension that takes place between Christianity and evolution. but then they were asking me, well, could you tease that out more? Like, what exactly is the frustration? And you know, what is actually some of the historical understanding of this? And I thought, you know, we really need to do a show where we just talk about, how did we get here? How did we get to this fight that's taking place between Christianity and evolution? And what's perhaps a more balanced understanding of the topic? And at least if you want to understand it more from our perspective, how we wrestle through this. I mean, not that long ago, I actually wrote, I don't know if you remember this, Steve, I wrote a blog a couple years ago. I believe I titled it, Why I Don't Care About Evolution.
Yep, I remember that one.
And that one got a lot of attention. And in that, I got a chance to explain a little bit of why I wrote that. But I'm hoping in this podcast that we can expand this a little more and really get into this issue historically in a way that will bring a little more clarity. And to do that, I think the best way to talk about this is to start by talking about the first battle, if you will, between Christianity and evolution, which took place in the Scopes trial, often called the Scopes monkey trial.
Yeah, so what is the Scopes trial? On July 10th, 1925, so that's 93 years ago yesterday, in Dayton, Tennessee, the Scopes trial, also known as the monkey trial, began. A science teacher named John Scopes was accused of teaching evolution in the Tennessee public school, which a recent bill had made illegal. John Scopes had his students refer to a book called the Hunter's Civic Biology Textbook. So the law made it a misdemeanor punishable by fine, quote, to teach any theory that denied the story of the divine creation of man as taught in the Bible, and to teach instead that man has descended from a lower order of animals. The trial concluded on July 21st of 1925. The jury took 9 minutes to pronounce Scopes guilty. He was fined $100, around $1,400 in today's currency. The verdict actually went on a little bit later on, a couple years later. It was actually overturned. But this really was a defining moment in this discourse between evolution and Christianity. Oh, I was just going to mention the two lawyers in the trial.
The two main lawyers.
The two main lawyers was Clarence Darrow was with the defense, and he is known for his defense in the Leopold and Loeb murder trial.
That's right.
Yeah.
And he is an agnostic. In that trial, with the Leopold and Loeb trial, he argued very much from a deterministic worldview.
Yeah.
And so you right there, you can see between these two lawyers that this is where the tension is,
yeah,
is focused.
Yeah. And I heard that once Darrow heard that Brian was going to be in it, he jumped in with both feet right away.
He basically begged to be a part of this trial. Yeah.
Interesting other statistic, H.G. Wells, the author, was actually asked to defend John Scopes, which was interesting.
Unbelievable.
Unbelievable, yeah.
Well, and actually part of that is when you look at this case, and by the way, let me just right off the bat, let me just give our listeners a treasure trove for you. There's a website called famoustrials.com. I'm telling you, if you're a student, you are going to be thanking me for years for this website. This thing is fantastic. It really is a treasure trove. It is the greatest collection online of primary sources of great trials or famous trials anywhere. That's one of the things I love about this website is you can look up all these different trials. And on that website, he's got primary sources and you can go through and look at these. So for example, part of this primary sources is you can see on there the Butler Act, as I believe it's called, where in the state of Tennessee, it was illegal to teach evolution. And so he'll have that bill there. And you can read that it's an act prohibiting the teaching of evolution theory in all universities, normals, and all other public schools of Tennessee, which are supported in whole or in part by the public school funds of the state, and to provide penalties for the violation thereof. Now, the penalty for teaching evolution was between $100 and $500. So you can see that when they fined Scopes, they went the lower end of the penalty.
Now, from what I understand, the Butler Act didn't necessarily prohibit the teaching of evolution wholesale, but it was really the teaching of human evolution that was the issue. And so it was technically not illegal to teach evolution, and the textbook that was required in public schools throughout Tennessee actually described evolution. And so in a sense, if teaching evolution at all is a misdemeanor, then every teacher in the state of Tennessee who taught in public schools, they were breaking the law.
As you look at the trial and you read Brian's arguments and Darrow's, what you begin to see as well is that one of the main contentions, like you're saying, Steve, isn't necessarily that evolution was being taught, but particularly human evolution and teaching it as a fact instead of showing that there was other possibilities such as the Bible. Now, one of the reasons why I'm bringing this up and that I want to bring up the Scopes trial is because there is often in history, particularly as we study history, there can be a propensity to either look at history one-sidedly or when you are studying history, depending upon who's teaching it to you, it's very easy to get a one-sided view of a historical event. When it comes to the Scopes trial, I find that this is particularly the case. In fact, a lot of people are even surprised to hear that Christians won that. Now, as Terry mentioned, it was eventually overturned, I believe, the next year.
1927.
One of the things that we see is it's easy to get this one-sided view of a topic. And I find that this is just clearly the case here. And what I wanted to do as we talk about this is really to give a two-sided view. Where did the Christians have it right? And where did they have it wrong? Where did the defense, you know, have it right, you know, as they're looking at evolution, and where did they have it wrong? And I think that this would be helpful for us to kind of understand where we're at today, because I don't know about you guys, but the more I look at the Scopes trial, the more I see exactly how we got to where we are today in looking at this issue. But the first thing I want to mention is I want to talk about where Christians actually got it right. And this is one of those aspects that often is swept under the historical rug, and people have completely forgotten that there was good reason why Christians were concerned about evolution and were willing to take it to task. And I want to talk about that first, and then I want to talk about where guys like Brian went astray in this debate. Mm. And so to bring this up, one of the things that was of major concern to Christians as they saw evolution being taught was particularly as it was being taught with regards to human beings. Now, one of the historical realities that has been conveniently forgotten is that the book Origin of Species by Darwin had a subtitle. That subtitle is By Natural Selection or the Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. That's a significant subtitle, and I've talked about this before. To Darwin's credit, he didn't necessarily directly apply that to human beings, but that didn't stop his half-cousin Francis Galton from doing so, in which Galton coined the term, a Greek term, eugenics, meaning well-born. And in the United States, at exactly this time, eugenics was being embraced, it was being implemented, sterilization was being implemented. So eugenics was federally funded in 32 states in a variety of measures. And so you could imagine the growing concern that was taking place with regards to this issue. And in particular, Hunter's Civic Biology, which was the textbook that Scopes was using, if you go to page 196, you can see what he was teaching. And I just want to read this for our listeners so you can gain an appreciation for part of the tension that was taking place at that time. This high school textbook reads as follows. The races of man. At the present time, there exists upon the earth five races or varieties of man, each very different from the other in instinct, social customs, and to an extent in structure. These are the Ethiopian or Negro type originating in Africa, the Malay or brown race from the islands of the Pacific, the American Indian, the Mongolian or yellow race, including the natives of China, Japan, and the Eskimos, and finally, the highest type of all, the Caucasians, represented by the civilized white inhabitants of Europe and America. that's what we're talking about with regards to eugenics and the kind of racism that it was fueling at that time. And so it's interesting because there's a moment in the trial where Darrow is speaking. So he is cross-examining a student that sat in Scopes's class and asks him, he's being sarcastic as he's talking here, and he says, with regards to the evolution that he was teaching him, well, did he tell you anything else that was wicked? And so he's being cheeky here, kind of going, listen, evolution isn't that bad. I mean, come on. He's just talking about biology. It's not like he's talking about anything wicked, right? Now, it's funny. Here we are, as you said, Terry, what is it, 93 years later?
93, yep.
And we're looking back on it. We're going, well, actually, it was wicked what was being taught. Now, that part of the wickedness, though, of this trial and what was being taught has been conveniently forgotten.
Prior to that, if we just go back a few years, I mean, just before Darwin, evolution, the concept was there. He was just faster than the other guys to get it on paper and out, right? And the theologians around that time felt that there was a connection between Christianity and this evolution. There was some acceptance of it, right?
Oh, absolutely. There wasn't this mass opposition. And I'd say that that mass opposition didn't come until after this trial.
Right. There was a lot of support from the Christians in this area of evolution. And then the trial comes in this link to eugenics. And then from there—
Which had been building to a boiling point that you see happening right here at this trial.
Yeah.
Because a lot of listeners also need to understand that it would be from the eugenics that is developing in the United States that would inspire the Nazis in the work that they would do with it.
The other interesting thing is that the rise of this young earth creationism kind of spawned out of this, where they held to the scriptures, the biblical inerrancy and the six-day literal days of creation. Before that, I mean, you go back to the founding fathers—
There was an openness
to
the earth being old. There's older. No doubt about that.
So anyway.
And interestingly, when you look at the trial, Brian is open to the 6 days being periods. And in fact, that ultimately got him a lot of heat from fundamentalists that he was open to that. So what we talked about here is we talked about, okay, here's an aspect where Christians had it right. They were justified in their concern.
There is one thing that I want to just kind of highlight again. I mean, it was briefly mentioned, but the connection between eugenics and racism too, that if you were of an inferior race, as they thought of you, then you were expendable, you were disposable. In fact, just like you said, I mean, this led to the Holocaust, you know, the Nazis killing whoever they thought was inferior. In fact, I mean, we look back and we go, wow, what an evil thing. But the Nazis themselves actually thought they were doing humanity a service by doing this. They're cleaning the gene pool of humanity. And around the time of the Scopes trials too, I think some listeners might be surprised to find out, or not, that Margaret Sanger was a eugenicist. And she was very outspoken about sterilizing, guess who? The Negroes. Margaret Sanger, if you don't know who she is, she's the founder of Planned Parenthood, what is today Planned Parenthood. There's this link between eugenics and racism that definitely needs to be highlighted there.
And the sad reality is that this is still the case today. You see, one of the things that people often forget about the way that evolution works is preservation of favored races in the struggle for life. And the idea being that in this evolutionary gradient, that there would be some that would be more evolved than others. And this is where the challenge really comes in. And you often see this, by the way, in those evolutionary, you know, posters, right? That starts off with a chimp and then the chimp, you know, is on all fours, but then the next picture, you know, he's starting to stand and starting to stand more. And then you see the picture of a man. And so you see this kind of gradient, right? Where you see, you know, this evolution from a chimp to a human being, and you say, oh, you know, that human being is more evolved than that chimp. Now you focus in on the human being, though, and you ask, well, what about human beings? Are some human beings more evolved than other human beings? And this is what that textbook is getting at, is it's saying, yes, there are different races of human beings, and some of them are more evolved than others. And in fact, the Caucasians are the most evolved. Now, this isn't something that has gone away, by the way. We'll put this on the show notes, but there's a study that was done called The Dark Psychology of Dehumanization. And in it, they asked them to judge different races of people, if you will, on a scale of how evolved they thought they were. So from Arabs, Russians, Muslims, Australians, Americans, Swedes, and where did they line up? And at the end, what they found was that Americans rated a 91.5. I found that interesting. They didn't even give themselves 100%, but they put themselves a 91.5, whereas Muslims ranked a 77.6 on the evolutionary scale. So you see this sort of racism. Oh, by the way, Europeans actually scored the highest at 91.9. So you already see this sort of racism that still exists today. The thing, though, that was different is at that time, Darwin was used as a scientific way to justify that racism.
If you look at that, I mean, the contrast between that and the Christian view of creation, just the foundation for value is just so different, right? So here is evolution, and human beings have sort of descended from chimps and apes and what have you. Because evolution sits on a spectrum, whenever you draw some kind of a line that distinguishes one segment from another, it ends up being arbitrary. So you look at, for example, you can create a segment called Caucasian, but why would you stop there? Why wouldn't you divide that even more finely so that there is just a tiny segment of the population that is actually valuable and the rest are expendable and disposable? Whereas the Christian view of the world, however you understand the creation account, one thing that everybody can agree on is that God created human beings in his image, and so human beings have this particular value that doesn't come in degrees, right?
And nor can it be taken away.
Right, because it's not something that's coming from inside of us. It's coming from the outside. And so it is objective, that value.
Another way you could say that is it's something that you're born with. No human being gave it to you. So this is, you know, the area where Christianity has got it right. And actually, I'd add to that as well that Brian explains that one of the reasons why he gets involved in the Scopes trial is because he's concerned about what's happening in the university and the number of young people that are leaving the faith because of evolution being taught as truth. So that's interesting. So that's all the way back in 1925. That was his rallying call. And interestingly, during the Scopes trial, he is spending his evenings out and about at rallies speaking and drumming up support for his cause. Now, this is where I think Brian starts to go astray, and I would say that the Christians get this absolutely wrong, and this is one of the areas that I personally am frustrated by. And so I bring this up because I want listeners to understand the historical basis for this, and I've tracked it down to the Scopes trial. And you see this where Brian makes the comment where he says, quote, "The contest between evolution and Christianity is a duel to the death. If evolution wins, Christianity goes." This is the false dilemma that I think we have to talk about.
Yeah, evolution has just become such a shibboleth in the Christian circles, right? Depending on your acceptance or rejection of evolution, now all of a sudden you're marked as a faithful Christian or not, in some circles anyway. And I find it really unfortunate that for those that are working in the apologetics ministry, that so many Christians are looking to them to canonize a particular interpretation of the early chapters of Genesis. because I'm thinking to myself, well, this is supposed to be an in-house debate. And when we are doing the apologetics ministry sort of to those that are outside, that's what apologetics, in my mind, you know, that's what it's supposed to be. You're trying to give the reason for the hope that you have in you when people that don't have that hope ask you, right? And so does this have to be that stumbling block? Like, do you have to accept a particular interpretation of that before you can even come to know Jesus? I mean, I think that's a terrible way to go about it. And so
Well, this becomes that false dilemma, I think, that you're getting at here, Steve.
Right.
And that is that either you believe evolution is true, and thus you have to be an atheist, or you can't be a Christian, or you believe that evolution is false, and then you can become a Christian. And this is the false dilemma that I would say that we have. And to go along with what you're saying here, Steve, as I believe what you're saying is the reason that this is an in-house debate is because when you look at the topic of evolution, the question that you're asking isn't who did it, you're asking how they did it. And so this then isn't a question that excludes God's existence. It would be a question of how God did it. This to me becomes the challenge. Let me just give a little bit more of background into this, because one of the things that, again, I would say that Brian gets wrong, that the Christian Brian in this case gets wrong, is he says repeatedly that evolutionists have, quote, no proof to support their theory. And then he goes on to say, and they can't even tell you how life began. And I would say that he's got it wrong and right. I think he's got it wrong in that to say that there is no proof for evolution is misleading. And this is one of the things that I bring up a lot with Christians, because I find a lot of Christians aren't nuanced enough when they talk about evolution, particularly when they're making a distinction between micro and macro evolution. Virtually all Christians de facto and all people just de facto agree that there is small change over time we would call microevolution. We see that. That to me is unquestioned. And in fact, I don't even see people really questioning that. And that's the problem, though, is because I find that for those in the secular community, they see Christianity as throwing the baby out with the bathwater kind of thing, right? It's just whole hog denial of evolution, which to them just seems like intellectual suicide. Because of course there is small change over time. We see that. So, you know, these Christians, they're just absolute idiots.
When it comes to the Scopes trial, I think one of the reasons why it was so black and white, I mean, it's certainly possible that, you know, William Jennings Bryan was really just that black and white. But I think partly what contributed to that, I think, is because this trial was deliberately publicized. Dayton, Tennessee was a small town, and they had a lot to gain from publicizing this particular trial. And so from what I understand, John Scopes, he wasn't even sure that he had taught human evolution, but he decided to, I think at the recommendation of some people, he decided to just go with it anyway. And
he volunteered to be a part of this test case.
Yeah. And some of the students that testified against Scopes, namely that he did teach human evolution. I think it was the defendant's side that actually instructed them to say these things. Right. And so this gets publicized. This is gaining national attention. And so then people start digging their heels in a little bit more, and it becomes more black and white. You know, it's either evolution or Christianity, so on and so forth.
Now, one thing that's interesting, by the way, in this trial that Brian brings up repeatedly in the court case is that his beef with evolution is from a scientific point of view. That first and foremost, it was from a scientific point of view. He didn't see the evidence for it. Secondarily, it was with regards to Christianity. And in that way, I would agree with him. That's personally where I've come at it from as I look at it. Because one of the questions that I want to ask is when you look at something like evolution, well, what support do we see for it? And I would argue that absolutely you see support for microevolution. Now, the other question, though, is, okay, well, what support do we see for macroevolution? And this is where I think that somebody like Brian in this court case, you know, would have needed to been more nuanced in exactly what he was contesting. And that is, do we see large change over time? Did human beings come from monkeys, which is what he brings up repeatedly? Particularly, you can see it with regards to talking about savages or whatnot, and this tie with eugenics is a major question that's being drawn out here. That's a whole nother subject, and there's a lot of debate that goes on with if that's possible and what are the implications of that. And now this then becomes a question that Christians would need to wrestle with. And in particular, if you're a Christian that holds to macroevolution, what is the engine that's driving that? Now, from a Darwinian, a neo-Darwinian perspective, that would be random mutation is what's driving that via natural selection. So one question that comes in, and maybe this would be for a whole nother podcast, is do we see evidence that given enough time that random mutation via natural selection could account for the large changes that you would see, say, from a wolf-like creature evolving to a whale, for example, or from a chimpanzee to a human being? You know, is there just even enough time? Do we see that sort of change taking place? Now, you can read great books by guys like Michael Behe in his book, Darwin's Black Box, or a really great book is The Edge of Evolution. And he brings up a really important case. And that is, he looks at parasites and asks, listen, when we look at parasites in the human body, such as malaria, you know, and think about a parasite like an animal. He said, you can have up to a trillion of those in your body if you get malaria. And now this is an interesting test case because he's saying, listen, we can look at what sorts of random mutation take place in malaria when we're talking in the trillions and what that would look like, say, if that was how many millions of years worth of rat evolution, for example, would that equate to? And what sorts of change do we see in malaria? And ultimately what we see is very little. And in fact, it's actually a good thing that we don't see very much change given that. Or else, man, things would be changing at the macro level of small things, not to confuse that with the macroevolution, but would be changing radically and constantly given the sort of random mutation that's being applied with regards to evolution.
I mean, a lot of the scientists point to the fossil records to prove evolution, right? Connecting with that. Because, I mean, one guy in 1981, a scientist said, at that time, there's 100 million fossils identified and dated. And he said, the fossils constitute 100 million facts that prove evolution beyond any doubt whatever. That's fact. Evolution is fact because we have these fossils.
That's what this person's saying.
Yeah.
Right. Now, this brings into a whole lot of questions, right? So if you see a fossil, for example, of what looks like a missing link between, say, a chimpanzee and a human being, one of the questions that's asked is, well, is that just an extinct type of monkey that we don't have any longer? Or is that a transition? That then becomes an open discussion. Now, others, though, are going to bring this back to what I think is an important question. And that is, when you look at something like the Cambrian explosion, where you see a lot of diversity of life happening all at once, you have to ask the question, well, where did all that diversity come from and how quickly it arrived? This is a precursor to an even more important question, I would say. And this is something that Brian brings up, getting back to his quote that I think he's right, when he says that it doesn't tell you how life began. And that's absolutely correct. A lot of people make this jump. And I was talking to somebody about this just the other day, where they were making a jump thinking that evolution could explain everything. And again, it's a how, not a why. So with regards to life evolving, you first have to have life, particularly from a neo-Darwinian perspective. You would need replication. You would need the engine to be able to take place of random mutation via natural selection, right? You would need that to be able to take place, but that would require life to begin with. So now this raises that important question. Well, where did life come from to begin with? So for example, you've got Christians that are on a variety of different perspectives on this. So you got creationists, and within the creationist camp, you have a number of different types of creationists, from young earth creationists to old earth creationists. Then you've got this movement of intelligent design that says, listen, the universe didn't happen by chance, it happened by design. By the way, that's an important concept. One of the things that we've talked a lot about on the show is the dangers of determinism, that when you no longer have an intelligent agent in the design process, then you've got one of two options. You've either got a determined universe in which you've got a lot of problems there, such as how do you account for human beings? How do you account for moral actions? But on the flip side, evolution is using randomness, which you have all of the same problems of determinism you have with randomness. Again, how are you going to account for a human being? How are you going to account for morality and values and rights, all these sorts of things that we cherish? How do you account for those on determinism and randomness? Well, the intelligent design is going to develop a foundation from a personal God, so that this isn't a random nor a determined universe. This is a purposeful universe. Now then, on the far extreme from that, or the next, is you have theistic evolutionists. Now, those people would argue that God exists and he has used evolution, but in that camp, you have a varying degree of opinions as well, from people believing that God is the active agent that is driving the evolutionary process, to those who believe that it's still random mutation, which raises some serious concerns of how God purposely created human beings if it was a random process.
So, I mean, I think you're saying that this is an open discussion with Christians in different camps of what they believe, right?
That's exactly what I'm getting at.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, what about the Bible? I mean, this is going to take it a step farther. Does Genesis or the Bible have anything to say about this? I mean, this is probably another show,
right?
Or two or three.
Well, do you know, interestingly, in the Scopes trial, that's where this went. And Darrow wanted to get Brian on the stand, and everybody's like, Brian, you shouldn't do that. But Brian, this is an area where I'd say that he got it wrong, is he let his ego get the best of him, and he was ready to battle and wanted to show how the Bible could answer these sorts of questions. And so he gets on the stand, and an epic 2-hour battle takes place between Darrow and Brian with regards to how do you understand the Bible and how does it answer these sorts of questions, and whether or not you're going to take a literalist view of everything in the Bible, or if you're going to take a more nuanced view, and how that's going to play out. And that's where I think that you run into some real trouble when you, with regards to how do you have this conversation, whether it's an in-house conversation or whether or not in this case you've got an agnostic asking a Christian. And in many ways, I'd say you've got two different worldviews just passing by each other and how you're going to look at that. So ultimately, I would agree with you. That would be a whole nother subject to talk about. You know, how are you going to read the Bible? How are you going to look at, like, for example, Adam and Eve? Are they historical figures? Are they not? In what ways are you going to look at Genesis? Now, I would recommend, there's a great book out there. I believe it's called 4 or 5 Views of Genesis. And I have found that was incredibly helpful, at least gave you a lay of the land of where Christians have landed on that subject as they're looking particularly at the Bible. But I think it comes back to that idea, though, that we've been trying to drive here, is you need to have a better understanding of the history of how we got here. You need to appreciate that this question is much more nuanced than people are allowing it to be, and give people space to work through this question and not make this false dilemma of either it's evolution or Christianity, but you can't have both, when in reality, we already have both. It's more nuanced than that. We already accept the micro. Now it's just, what level are you accepting the macro, and how are you teasing that out? It's a how question, not a who question.
Well, our time has got away on us. So thank you for joining us, listeners. The AC Podcast is a ministry of Apologetics Canada, and we'll be back next week with more things to think about.